on this 25th day of January 2011 in San Diego. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 18, entitled The Perfection of Renunciation, and we are on Text 14. Adishtanam tatakarta Kadanam chapadagvidham Vibhidhas chapatak cheshta Daivam chayvatra panchamam. The place of action, the body, the performer, the various senses, the many different kinds of endeavor, and ultimately the supersoul, these are the five factors of action. Purport. The word adhisthanam refers to the body. The soul within the body is acting to bring about the results of activity and is therefore known as karta, the doer. That the soul is the knower and the doer is stated in the Shruti. Esha hi drashta thrashta, the Prashna Upanishad 4.9. It is also confirmed in the Vedanta Sutra by the verses Vyo ta eva 2.3.18 and karta shastra tavat 2.3.33. The instruments of action are the senses, and by the senses the soul acts in various ways. For each and every action there is a different endeavor, but all one's activities depend on the will of the supersoul, who is seated within the heart as a friend. The Supreme Lord is the supercause. Under these circumstances, he who is acting in Krishna consciousness under the direction of the supersoul situated within the heart is naturally not bound by any activity. Those in complete Krishna consciousness are not ultimately responsible for their actions. Everything is dependent on the supreme will, the supersoul, the supreme personality of Godhead. Om jnana tamarandasya jnanandana shalakaya chakshu unmiditam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So I always found this verse and this description of the different elements of action interesting in contrast to third chapter, text 27. Actually, we can turn to that since we all have books. 327 is this famous verse about the wilded soul and false ego. So 327 states, Prakate kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha ahankara vimudhatma kartahamiti manyate. The spirit soul, bewildered by the influence of false ego, thinks himself the doer of activities that are in actuality carried out by the three modes of material nature. So here, it's said that the soul is not the doer. But in the text in 18.14, he is the doer. The karta is right here, is one of the five elements of action. So how do we reconcile these seemingly contradictory elements? The idea is that under the spell of the material energy, the living entity feels himself to be an independent doer. In other words, the soul is certainly an important element here. Without the soul, there would be no motive for action in the material world. This is all talking about action in this world. So the soul has a very important function here. Basically, the soul is desiring in different ways. And also the soul has a certain amount of will, a certain desire. It's tied up with the will that things will happen in a certain way. Now, let's see. We also have the body and the senses. So the body is like the place where everything takes place. Just like we say, you have these five knowledge-acquiring senses, the Gyanendriya. So it seems like there are things out there, right? There are certain colors, there's forms that you see, there are smells you smell, there's things you hear. But actually the experience of it is really taking place in your senses and your mind. In other words, you're hearing something, and the way that your senses are set up, you're hearing at a distance, and you're projecting, oh, it's coming from 100 feet away or over there. But really, the whole thing is vibrating in your ear here, right? If the ear is, you know, plugged up, or if you're deaf, then you don't hear anything. So the whole experience, as I say, this is the field of our experience, the chaitra. So it's all, here it's also saying it's also the place of our action. because really we're doing everything with these active senses also. It's also part of the body. So that's where I say it's the place of action. And the performer, that's the karta, that's the doer, that's the soul. Then what do you do, what do you act with? Well, you act with the senses, both the gyanendriya and karmendriya, in the knowledge acquiring and the active senses. Right? We have 10 of senses. We have the knowledge acquiring senses, the eyes, the ears, the sense of taste, touch, and smell. And then you have the active senses. Most important for the devotee, I was discussing this with Bhakta Tim the other day on the phone, because he lost his voice. He couldn't do his service. You know, the voice is a very important active sense. So much is done with the voice, you know, critical things. But you also have the hands and the legs, and for procreation, there's the genitals, and you have the excretory function. So there's 10 there. And so these are the various senses. And then there is the will, the many kinds of endeavor, but ultimately there's a super soul. Now in chapter 13, there's that important verse, Upadrashta Anumantacha, Bhakta Bhakta Maheshwara. That the super soul is overseeing everything. He's watching everything, and he's the sanctioner. It's important to differentiate between the fact that he's sanctioning all these activities and that he wants them to take place. He doesn't really have any desire that this material activity is taking place. But he's giving us the chance to perform these activities, to play out our karma, play out our desires, and ultimately to come to the point of realizing that this really isn't our ideal field of activity. The ideal field of activity is in the spiritual realm, where our desires and our will are completely in tune with those of the Supreme Lord. Now there's a disjunction, because we've forgotten the main element of these five, namely the super soul. The super soul is Krishna, and we've forgotten that higher order, and so we're responsible. The point is that if you act as if you're an independent actor on your own account with your own desires, trying to enjoy the fruits, then you're responsible for the activities. You become attached to the fruits, and if you violate the universal law of karma, which is set up by Krishna ultimately, then you're going to either suffer, or you'll maybe enjoy some material benefit, or you'll suffer some punishment according to your activities. So understanding that this is called Sankhya, this is a little element of Sankhya here. We have various little parts of Bhagavad Gita where you have analysis of what this world is, who, how we fit into it, how we act in this world. This is all called Sankhya Yoga analysis. But the ultimate purpose of this Sankhya is to come to the understanding of the role of the super soul, of our role as ultimate servants of the super soul or Krishna, so that we will break our entanglement with this material energy. You see, these activities, these senses that we have, this feel that we have, this is not natural to the soul. These actually act as kind of a prison for us. You know, the prison warden is like the super soul, overseeing, awarding punishment, you know, giving us a little... But we're not meant to be imprisoned in this complicated material energy. So, but understanding this is very significant. And Krishna will say, in sect 16 here, one who thinks he's the only doer, not considering the five factors, is not intelligent and cannot see things as they are. And we suffer for that. So this is, you know, this is a very enlightening. By learning these things, we can begin to detach ourselves from the entanglement of considering ourselves the independent actor. As Krishna says in that verse we looked at, prakate kriyama gunai karmani sarvashaha ahankara vimunata karta hamiti manyate, that the material energy is working, you know, everything is taking place. These senses, this body, is also part of the material energy. But we're thinking it's us. We're thinking I'm doing it independently. So it's taking place by the material energy. But one who thinks kartaham ita manyate, he's bewildered by ahankara. The word ahankara means ego. Now I remember Mukunda Dutt told me, you know, because we say ahankara means I'm the doer, but actually ahankara means activity that increases the sense of I-ness, that makes you think I, the separate sense of I-ness. That's what ahankara. You know, doing things that deepen your involvement in the sense of being a separate ego and competing with all the others. You know, rather than being part of a unified team that's meant to serve Krishna. And in the spiritual world, you don't have that sense of I-ness in the sense of having a different interest, a separate interest from the Supreme Lord. So this is what ahankar means, and that ahankar is the main binding factor that keeps us bound to this world. There's a very illuminating portion of the third canto describing how the false ego, in contact with all the different modes of nature, gradually produces the senses, the sense objects, the mind, the intelligence, the demigods. Everything is produced because of that contact of the false ego with the material energy. And so when we act on the basis of real ego, what our real identity is, even though we're still in this material world, you know, that's the difference between acting selfishly and acting for Krishna. You know, acting for Krishna is bhakti. Then we begin to reverse the process. You know, gradually all of these senses and all of these things that have developed because of our false ego, they're sublimated and spiritualized by being used in the service of Krishna. And ultimately, we don't need a material body. The soul does not need a material body to live happily. In fact, you can only live happily without a material body, ultimately. So that's, you know, that this analysis is very cogent, and Krishna will go on describing it in the next three or four verses. Yeah.
So how does the soul interact with the body? Because, you know, I've always heard that in spirit...
Categorically different. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I've always heard that the two can't mix.
No, it's true. In fact, at the end of chapter 13, there's a verse like that. You know, just as the air doesn't really mix with space, you know, although it seems to, similarly, the soul doesn't mix with the body. Anybody. It doesn't matter what body it's in. But there's a complicated arrangement for how the soul interacts with the body. Basically, it's the way I understand is that the soul desires, and the super soul understands that desire, and the material energy is under the control of the super soul via the gods. You know, it's a very complicated arrangement. So you know, I'm desiring to pick up this glass of water. Well, what just happened there? You know, what just happened? I mean, we can analyze it. You know, there was a desire, the brain waves started to kick off, right? And the nerves, you know, did a whole thing, the hand moved, the muscle contracted. I don't think about all those things, but that's what happened. You know, but what did I do as a soul? I just wanted it. I just wanted that to happen. And the super soul understood that desire and, you know, I was still eligible for picking up a glass of water. Some people, their arms paralyzed. No more water picking up, no matter how much they want it. You see? Some people can't walk anymore. Some people can't breathe anymore. You know? So that's, you know, so you're playing out your karma. And at a certain point, you can't do anything with the body. You need a new one, you know, to start doing all these things again. So the soul interacts with the material energy through the medium of the super soul, who then works with the demigods. Yeah?
Who's the doer again?
The doer is the doer in this context, in this verse, the doer is definitely the soul.
in the chapter 18.
That right here, chapter 18, 14.
I mean, that Vedanta, those two.
The work? Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't get the. It seems to be contradictory in the third chapter. 3:27.
Yeah, that's what I said. Karta hum iti manyate. Because what that 3:27 seems to be saying is that when you consider yourself the only doer, in other words, you're independent, that's the false ego. I mean...
That's one of three modes?
Huh?
That's one of three modes of the doer?
Well, you're still an actor. You're a doer in the sense of desiring. But you're considering that you're more than that. You're considering that you are independently acting. You're forgetting about the three modes. You know, this is the nature of the mode of passion. I'm great. I'm going to do, you know, I'm doing all these things independently until the material energy cuts you down and you realize you're dependent. You know, so often you hear Prabhupada talk about that. This is the false pride, you know, that even in English language you have this egotistical, you know, this word egotism, which means an exaggerated sense of oneself, you know. And that's what Krishna is talking about in 327. In other words, what do we really do? Even if you don't know these five factors, you realize that, oh, you know, we're so dependent on the grace of the material energy. Just for our next breath, you know, the body is so dependent. So to consider yourself independent of the laws of nature, or that you can control this material, you know, this is a sign of the demons. So, you know, that's what's going on in the third chapter. But, you know, so often you hear devotees say, oh, don't think you're the doer, Prabhu, you know. Don't consider yourself the doer, right? So the idea is that we're not meant to consider ourselves independent actors. We're meant to consider that at every moment we need to be dovetailed with the will of the Lord. Pray to Him for the strength and the intelligence to do His service nicely, and that's the proper sense of being an actor, of being a. If you didn't have any will or ability to do anything, there wouldn't be any meaning to the injunctions of the Shastra. You know, this is one of the arguments. There has to be an element there of choice. Therefore, in one sense, we're a doer. But how that will, how that it plays out in the world, that's entirely up to higher forces. We can only desire. You know, this is a nice verse. Prahlad speaks this. You know, balasya neya shadanam pitaro nrisinga, that a father cannot protect a son, medicine cannot help a sick person, a boat cannot save one who is drowning in the ocean. And in general, anything you try to do in this world to relieve your suffering will not work without the sanction and the benediction of the Lord. That's the meaning of that verse. So this idea that's enunciated in the 11th chapter here, Nimitta Matram Bhavasavyasachan, you simply be my agent. I've already carried everything out. It's already going to happen, you know. You just be my agent in this battle, Arjuna, and that will be your perfection. That will be your, you know, your true identity. That's where our sense of ego comes in. So it's a delicate balance, but that's the way I understand.
The Vedanta Sutra part is actually saying that thing, that Shastra has meaning only if the...
Right, that's right. That 2.3.33.
Yeah, Karta Dura Shastra Arthavat Vat. For Shastra to have...
Meaning, there has to be a sense of you're independent doing.
Also, the previous one saying, Jyo Atayevai, meaning, because he is the knower, therefore he is.
Because he's the knower?
Because he is the knower. I mean, that means he is experiencing all of this.
Right.
So in that sense, he is ultimately thing on which the whole experience is resting, the soul.
Right.
So therefore,
right.
He has some element in it, like he's the doer.
Yeah.
And Esha Hidrashta Srashta, he's the one who's experiencing it, and Srashta, he is the cause of his... He's creating his bodies.
That's what the definition of karma. Yeah. Krishna gives an eight. All right, let's go on.
First example, sorry. That's from the second chapter.
He was just reading these little aphorisms from the one from the Upanishad. Is he in the purport here? Yeah, Esha hi drashta srashta. But this the second one exactly says there's a karta. The living enemy is a karta. Otherwise, the injunctions of the Shastra would have no meaning. That's the one I was quoting. All right, going on with 15. Sharira van mano biryat.
Sharira van mano biryat.
Karma prarabhate naraha.
Karma prarabhate naraha.
Nyayam va viparitam va.
Nyayam va viparitam va.
Panchayate tasya hetavaha.
Panchayate tasya hetavaha.
Whatever right or wrong action a man performs by body, mind, or speech is caused by these five factors. Purport, the words right and wrong are very significant in this verse. Right work is work done in terms of the prescribed directions of the scriptures, and wrong work is work done against the principles of the scriptural injunctions. But whatever is done requires these five factors for its complete performance. So again, you know, this recalls the end of the 16th chapter. You know, Shastra Bidamuchaja, one who disregards Shastra cannot achieve perfection, happiness, or the supreme abode. Therefore, in order to find out what is right and what is wrong, what to do and what not to do, we can consult Shastra and do it as a matter of duty. And this way, we attune ourselves to acting according to the will of the Lord, because the will of the Lord is reflected in Shastra. And that's the perfection. So we can't really get separated from Shastra to find out what's right and wrong. Yeah.
Do transcendental activities fall under these categories of right and wrong?
Yeah, that's transcendental activities. There are different stages of transcendental activities. Those in which one is spontaneously acting out of love for the Lord, there's no question of right or wrong. It's beyond that already. Right and wrong is for those who are trying to get free from the extrication, you know, or get extricated from the material. And that's where this right and wrong comes in. Tatraivam satikartaram. Atmanam kevalam tu yaha.
Atmanam kevalam tu yaha.
Pashyat akuta buddhidvan. Nasa pashyati durmatihi. Therefore, one who thinks himself the only doer, not considering the five factors, is certainly not very intelligent and cannot see things as they are. That comes in the 327. Vimudha, this word mudha means foolish. Purport, a foolish person cannot understand that the Supersoul is sitting as a friend within and conducting his actions. Although the material causes are the place, the worker, the endeavor, and the senses, the final cause is the Supreme, the Personality of Godhead. Therefore, one should not see only the four material causes, but the Supreme efficient cause as well. One who does not see the Supreme thinks himself to be the doer. Now here he puts the worker in the realm of the material cause, because this is all talking about a conditioned soul who's, you know, entangled in matter. But of course we have so many injunctions. Krishna's kara, sarva karana karana, right at the beginning of Brahma Samhita. So the cause of all causes, that's the very definition of the Supreme Absolute Truth. So, you know, keeping that all-encompassing cause in mind, then we can act properly, you know, understanding how to do that. Yasya naham kuto bhavo.
Yasya naham kuto bhavo.
Buddhir yasya nalipyate.
Buddhir yasya nalipyate.
Hatvapi sahi ma lokan.
Hatvapi sahi ma lokan.
Nahanti nanabadyate.
Nahanti nanabadyate.
One who is not motivated by false ego, whose intelligence is not entangled, though he kills men in this world, does not kill, nor is he bound by his actions. Purport. In this verse, the Lord informs Arjuna that the desire not to fight arises from false ego. Arjuna thought himself to be the doer of action, but he did not consider the supreme sanction within and without. If one does not know that a super sanction is there, why should he act? But one who knows the instruments of work, himself as the worker and the Supreme Lord as the supreme sanctioner, is perfect in doing everything. Such a person is never in illusion. Personal activity and responsibility arise from false ego and godlessness, or a lack of Krishna consciousness. Anyone who is acting in Krishna consciousness under the direction of the Supersoul or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though killing, does not kill, nor is he ever affected by the reaction of such killing. When a soldier kills under the command of a superior officer, he is not subject to be judged. But if a soldier kills on his own personal account, then he is certainly judged by a court of law. So this is like bringing it, you know, all back to the essential lesson here. And that is that when one is acting under the will of the Lord, then there's no entanglement in this world, even though it may seem like an abominable activity. Now, therefore, the critical factor is to be trained in such a way that one can always be acting under the will of the Lord, under the will of Krishna. It's not easy because we're not used to that. We have all other kinds of criteria that we act under. Mostly what's the demand of our senses, what's the demand of our mind, you know. Or we have other criteria, the state or this or that, who are giving us, you know, our sense of duty. But here Krishna is making it very clear. You have to act free of any sense of false ego. So our identification, you know, if we're acting under the identification as a servant of Krishna, then we're free of any entanglement. Even externally, it seems like an abominable activity, which is exactly what Arjuna thought. Arjuna thought that this war is horrible because I'm going to be killing my guru, my friends, my worshipable grandfather Bhishma and so many others. So on an ego platform, he wanted to give it up. You see, on a false ego. But then he's detaching himself from Krishna's will, and so he's going to be responsible for that. You know, he would become sinful, and it says in one place, go to hell by not fighting rather than by fighting. That's really what the bottom line is. So this is very encouraging. When you apply this principle in devotional service, it means that your very endeavor to work in this way is success. In other words, there are so many tasks to perform in Krishna consciousness. If you just want to perform them and you try to perform them, then you've succeeded. For instance, suppose you want to come to Mangalarti. You may not live in the temple. You know, I had this experience once. For a while, this is the farthest away I lived from a temple was in Atlanta in 1978. We had a house in the suburbs of Atlanta, and we would drive every morning 15 minutes, which is, you know, a good ways, to Mangalartik. My responsibility was trying to get everybody up in this little ashram house we had. Now, we had this van, and one morning it was just super cold. I don't know, it was just freezing cold, in this, you know, and it was so cold we were afraid the van was going to break down. In fact, I think it did. And we went about 3 or 4 blocks and we realized, my God, if this van breaks down and we're in the middle of halfway there, we're going to freeze to death. So we actually got out of the van and we ran back to the house. In fact, I remember running past the house because it was so dark, you know. Now, wait a minute, we missed the house, we had to run back. Get back in the house and stay warm. It was, it was very penetrating, wet cold, you know. And we couldn't go to Mangalarti that day, you know. But, you know, we felt that, we had tried. You know, we had made the endeavor. So, of course, you want to be able to go to Mangalarti and see the deities and everything. But the idea is that Krishna sees your effort. Whereas on the material sphere, you know, if you don't complete it, what do you get? You know, I think of like building a bridge. You know, it's so hard to build a bridge. I remember reading about how they built the Brooklyn Bridge. It was a great, at the time, architectural feat to build it. I think it was the first major suspension bridge ever built in America. And, you know, all of the money and the figuring it out, the first time they put the piles down into the water, you know, the people died, you know, the main... architect and engineer got the bends, you know, he had to come up and he was permanently injured, you know, he was crippled, but he was still looking over and the thing from his window and guiding thing, and his wife would go down and give the orders, and, you know, so much money spent, and finally, it was built, you know. But just imagine if they tried all of that, you know, and an earthquake came or something, or, you know, they ran out of money. You know, you see this in India a lot, right, half-built buildings, you know, even here you see them now. You know, so what do you get? Nothing. You know, you put all that money in, all that effort in, and it's a half-built building, a half-built bridge, you know. So that's really symbolic of all material effort. Because ultimately, you lose with the material. Because whatever you have stays here. You're not related to Krishna. Well, you're always related to Krishna, but it has nothing to do with bhakti. It's just some material effort that you put out, no matter what it is. I got a degree, I got this job, I made so much money, had so many kids, this and whatever. You know, so it's a life. But then at the end, the body stays here and molders in the ground, as they say, finished. And you go off to a whole different place, a whole different body, a whole different situation to start all over again, you know, to do something else. So what happened to all that effort? You got nothing. You know, in fact, you got negative because you got more and more entangled in this world. Likely in this age, you commit a lot of sin and suffering. So the idea is this is critical knowledge. How to act in a way that's not under the guide of ahankar. That activity that increases your sense of I-ness and separateness. That I'm the doer, I'm the independent doer, I'm the master, you know, the rugged individualism. That's silliness. So here, very critical, you know, even if you perform some activity that may seem bad, if it's truly and surely under the Shastra and under Krishna's instruction, then there'll be no reaction. And it's just like, you know, probably gives this wonderful analogy, like a soldier, you know, fighting a good war. The last one we had was World War II. If you've killed on the battlefield, you know, many soldiers, you get honored for that, you know, because you're killing the enemy. It's good. But the same activity on your own account, you get punished, you get arrested, you get hanged. So this is the idea that we have to do things in this world. You have to act in order to live. But if you do them in such a way that is part of devotional service, that it's not entangling, and more to the point, it's actually liberating. The very same activities of the senses, you know, when done for Krishna, they liberate. When done for oneself, they bind. It's as simple as that. Yes? Go ahead.
And it says personal activity and responsibility arise from false people and godlessness.
Yeah.
So, you know, we hear so often we should take responsibility for our own actions. So how do we understand that?
Well, the thing is, in the context of Krishna consciousness, you have this criteria. In other words, if you're acting really, you know, according to your duty, and you're doing what you know you should do in Krishna consciousness, you're not responsible in the sense that there's going to be a good or bad effect. This is the Naishkarmya principle. You know, Krishna talks about it in, I think, the fourth chapter. Though acting, you're not acting. You know, one who sees action and inaction, you remember that? So action and inaction means that if you're just sitting there, you know, contemplating all the objects of the senses, you know, whatever, you're acting. The mind is going on. That's the fruit of act, even though you're acting, you know. But if you're acting like crazy, you're doing so many things, but you're doing it for Krishna, you're not actually acting in the sense of a fruit of act. You see what I'm saying? That's the idea. So, but it's not easy to act all that way. So we need to be aware of our actions at all times. You know, and realize, is this an action on the basis of false ego, or is it an action on the basis of Krishna consciousness? That's what it means, taking responsibility. You know, yeah, we should be, you know, we should take responsibility in, say, an ashram situation. Means we should accept duty. We should accept a sense, yes, this is my duty to do this, you know, I know it is. And we're doing it, we know, you know, unlike anywhere else in this city, probably, you know, anywhere, we're doing it under this higher guidance, this higher principle of order, and therefore, you know, we're feeling, you know, you can actually feel it. You're becoming free. You're becoming free of this burden, you know, of trying to, you know, battle with the material energy, and somehow make success in this world, you know, fighting over the others. And you can see it, any Krishna conscious community, there's a different sense there. This is I've often thought of that, how a temple, you know, we have this Sunday feast, and people come, sometimes they come for years, new people come, and so, and there's something about it that's unique, you know, that you won't find. There's a sense of, you know, when there isn't this, like if you walk into a bar, you walk into a club, you walk into any other place where people gather, or a stadium or something, there's this sense of ego, this sense of modes of passion, you know, modes of passion and ignorance are there. But here, it's just like this peacefulness. There isn't this competition. There's no, you know, underlying sense of sexual competition and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's a different mode. And that's because you see devotees, they're serving. They're serving Krishna. You know, everything reminds you of Krishna. It's all based on that glorification principle. So it's dissolving. You know, there's a very nice verse in the third canon about dissolving the false ego. You know, dissolving the these two bodies. You know, we have these two bodies. It's stula sharira and the linga sharira, which we call the gross and the subtle body. And those bodies, we've been cultivating for a long time, especially this subtle body. And so Krishna consciousness, bhakti, it dissolves it in the sense of spiritualizes, you know. And that you still have the body, but it's not, it's becoming your friend. You know, even, just like it says in the sixth chapter, the mind can become your friend. You know, if you use it for, the controlled mind is your friend, and the uncontrolled mind is your enemy. The body can also be your best friend. There's this nice verse in the 87th chapter. We went through the 87th chapter a few months ago, remember? The 10th canon. This is the songs of the Vedas, the personified Vedas prayers. And so I said, these are great. You know, I thought I'd memorize them. So I started to remember. So I two of those are still left in my brain. So one of them is just about this, you know, the alternative between working for Krishna and not. So it's Tvananupatam kulayam idama basurit priyavat. Chadatita tonma keetvi hite priya atmanicha. Nabatatahantaho asadupasana ya mahano yadarushaye bamantu dubaye kushadiri prata. Yeah, nabatatamantaho. So what he's saying there is that, my dear Lord, this human body is perfectly suited to serve you. Anupatam. Kulayam. This kulayam is another word for body. And anupatam means following your path. In other words, serving you. And when we do use our senses, our body, bodies, you know, mind also, in Krishna's service, then atma surit priyavat. The atma, the body becomes like the very self, because it's acting on the soul basis, and it's very dear to us, and it's our best friend. Yeah. And on your side, as the super soul, you're always looking out for the welfare of such a soul. You also become dear to them. So this is the natural position. But the second half of the verse is, Nabatatamantaho, that alas, there are so many souls who, and this is very significant, don't take their pleasure in serving you in this way. Ramanti, aho. So what do? Asodopasanaya. They worship the impermanent. They worship the material world. And in this way, atmahano, they perform spiritual suicide. And then yadunushaye bramanti, life after life, they're trying to fulfill these desires separate from you, and they wander, different bodies, different worlds, different levels. Brahman udubaye in kushadira prata, amongst different kushadira, means like lower animal bodies or different, you know, human bodies that are not very auspicious, which are very fearful, udubaye. All in that one verse. It's a lot in there, you know. But it's exactly like that, you know, that when we use the body, then the body becomes, that's spontaneous devotion. You know, can you imagine if, like if your mind was so, you know, saturated with Krishna, that you couldn't help thinking of Krishna? You know, now we're struggling to remember Krishna. But at a certain point, the mind is naturally flowing to Krishna. In fact, there's another nice verse, if you forgive me. This is from the Krishna Karnamita. You know, very high level where the gopis are complaining. They do this in the Brahma Gita. When Radharani says, Kimiya kunamok kasya bruma kutum kutamashaya. Katayata katamanyam danya mahodideyeshaya. Madura madura smera kare manona yanotsave kupana kupana krishne tishna chidambatalumbate. But probably haven't heard that first quote in the class before. So he's saying that. So one gopi is saying to the other, says, Radharani speaking, do something. Give me a kundama. Let everything we've been doing now to try to meet Krishna be finished. Enough already. Kasya bruma. Say something auspicious, but whatever you do, don't say anything about Krishna. Katayata katam anyan damya. Say something danya, but anya from Krishna. But said, aho, vidyeshaya. But alas, oh my goodness, he's in our hearts. Vidyeshaya. Morada morada smera kare, with his beautiful smiling, sweet, sweet smiling form. Manona yanetsa, which is a festival for our mind and eyes. Kripana kripana, Krishna, this wretched desire to meet Krishna is increasing at every moment. You know, so this is the gopis at this highest level. So, the idea is that their minds are saturated with Krishna. There's no question of thinking of Krishna. But that's the natural way to be. You know, this whole separation from Krishna, forgetting him, working at false ego, this is all unnatural for the soul.
So what's that mood? They're trying to not think of Krishna. What's that mood?
You want some technical name for it? I think it's in the, you know, I can find it for you. There's the Brahma Gita is this Radharani's song to the bee. Uddhava comes back to Vrindavan. Krishna's left. He's gone to Mathura. So Krishna sends Uddhava to Vrindavan for him to learn the highest levels of devotion from the gopis, and also to pacify the gopis by giving him a message like that. So when Uddhava comes, then Radharani is in this high state of separation, and she sings this song to the bee. She's in this madness, and she's seeing a bee as a messenger of Krishna. And so she has this whole set of 10 verses to the bee, and each one of them, Vishnu Chakravarti has analyzed, embodies a certain kind of man talking. And one of them is this thing where, you know, we're trying not to think of you, but we can't stop thinking of you. You know?
The idea is he's left them, so they're...
He's left them, and there's so much pain of separation, you know, that they're trying to stop thinking of him. But alas, they can't, because he's too sweet. You know? So, there's that mention I remember in the Antalila, how, you know, this love of Krishna's separation is just like hot sugarcane juice. It's so sweet, you can't stop drinking it, but it's still burning, you know? Are you still... So that mixture of this transcendental pain and pleasure is the highest, actually, level. Lord Chaitanya, the... Yeah.
So you're talking about how, you know, when we do devotional service, then, you know, we don't incur any karma for that. But what about before we get to the point of devotional service?
What do you mean?
Well, like, you know, as a bhakti here, like, yeah, I definitely don't have any devotion, so I'm thinking that I do.
You're not incurring any karma. No, the karma, getting rid of the karma is like, you know, the first installment. As soon as you start chanting Hare Krishna, all your karma is gone. You know, but getting to the point of actual devotion takes more work. You have to chant purely for that. So I mean, you can feel it. You can see, you know, you can just look at you. You know, you can see there's so many eons of karma that's been gone off. But you know, getting to the point of purity, that takes a lot of work. So now you're performing devotional service. It's not devotional service at the highest level, obviously, but it's devotion. You're not doing it for your, you know, to make money. You know, you're doing it for Krishna. The point is, you're not always at every moment completely absorbed in thought of Krishna, but the fruit of the activity is always is being given, you know, for Krishna, and therefore there's no karma being incurred. Yeah.
So even if you're doing devotional service and your mind is not 100% on Krishna, just the fact that you're doing it for Krishna, even if your mind is wandering elsewhere, you're still in service to Krishna itself.
Totally. Okay. Third chapter: Yagyartad Kamanonyata Lokayam Kamabandhana. Activity should be formed as an act of sacrifice; otherwise, it binds one to this world. So that's on the level that we we're acting. You're doing it as an act of sacrifice, and you're trying to remember Krishna, chanting, you know, whatever. And so there's no karma being incurred, and you're gradually purifying. You get to the, you know, point. But that, you know, there's a whole section of the bhakti, you know, process: the chanting, seeing the deity, all these things which are not, you know, washing the pots.
Right.
You know, that part is very important.
Right.
Because your mind, the whole thing really, your mind,
right,
you know, is meant to be fixed on Krishna. And then when you're acting, everything becomes nectar, whether it's washing the floor or chanting in front of the deities. It's the same.
The different elements of karma are destroyed at different points. Like they say, the accumulated stock is destroyed. You know, and another karma which has not started, but they said prarabdha, that which has started, does not really actually start to be destroyed until you reach the stage of anartha nivritti. So we still have anartha. We're trying, but we still have anartha. To that, only after the stage of anartha nivritti is completed, they said two things happen. Your initiation is actually complete at that point. Initiation is not a one-time event. It's actually taking place. It's taking place when you...
There are various stages.
Initiation is completed at that point, and your prarabdha.
But the main question was, the question was that you're not incurring any new karma. You're not incurring any new karma. And you're you know, purifying.
Well, prarabdha might still be playing out.
Yeah.
You can get some disease.
We're still sitting in his body.
I'm getting this disease because Krishna is testing me. Like he was testing Pandavas, who were transcendental people, right? But we do have karma. I mean, we do have... devotees like him, you know, they're not accumulating any more karma because they're serving the Lord here. But at the same time, they might see some setbacks, like some disease, some issues.
Yeah.
But
we should never forget that the holy name is so powerful that it can destroy even the prarabdha karma.
But it is said that it's not like as soon as you have that initiation ceremony, not at that point.
Yeah, you have to come to the state of namabhas.
A
more advanced state.
Also,
We have a few minutes.
The understanding of this one is personal activity and responsibility arise from false ego and godlessness. Responsibility in the sense that we are responsible for what's happening to us. Bhunjaneva atma kritam vipakam. We are responsible. People like to point to other things. Oh, you know, blame this, blame that, blame the situation. But we have to ultimately, Bhagavatam is saying, Bhunjanev Atma Kritam Vipaka. That I'm responsible for this because I created this.
But Prabhupada is using this word, because this is where my long editing career comes in. Prabhupada would use these words responsibility in a different way. In other words, we are meant to take responsibility, just like you're saying, evatna kutam vipakam. But here he's talking about responsibility means being bound up because of your activities. Personal activity on your own account, and responsibility means, okay, you acted sinfully, you're going to have to... You kill the person on your own, then you have to, get it. But if you kill them for Krishna, then you don't get it. That's what responsibility means.
That's what I'm trying to say also. When we have to understand that something is happening to us, it's because in the past we have acted out of Krishna consciousness.
Of course.
And we are therefore we are responsible for what's happening to us now.
Right.
And we have to see it in that way. And
if we see it that way, we can be responsible for also getting free from that.
Yes.
So this is our freedom. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah.